It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So how do cooking rules come to be? The answer is they come to different people in different ways. Take Chef Justin Warner.
It started out as kind of reverse engineering things, understanding why a great dish that I had made sense, and then distilling compounds of the dish. For example, a great pizza from, you know, some Neapolitan place. Why does pizza almost always work? Well, you have something fruity, tomato, you have something rich and fatty, cheese, and then you have something to spread it on. And then if you look at peanut butter and jelly, it's the exact same thing. And so this kind of combination of fat, fruit, and something to spread it on is an archetype. It's a law.
The laws of cooking, how to evaluate a grocery store, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich is one of the first foods we learned to make as kids. It's a perfect flavor combination, and according to Chef Justin Warner, the principles behind a PB&J can be used to make other amazing flavor pairings, like tomato soup with grilled cheese ravioli and apricot and habanero wings. Well, Justin is a self-taught chef and host of Food Network's Foodie Call. He has used the concept of the PB&J to design nearly a dozen laws of cooking. Among them are the law of gin and tonic, the law of guacamole, and the law of, yes, cheese fries. He's collected them in a book, The Laws of Cooking and How to Break Them. And he sat down with our contributor, Von Diaz, in New York City.
Justin, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So I've probably had over 100 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in my life. But to be honest, I've never stopped to think about the chemistry behind it or even what makes it so delicious. How did you come up with these laws of cooking?
Well, it started out as kind of reverse engineering things, understanding why a great dish that I had made sense, and then distilling compounds of the dish. Take, for example, a great pizza from, you know, some Neapolitan place. Why does it always work? Why does pizza almost always work? Well, you have something fruity, tomato, you have something rich and fatty, cheese, and then you have something to spread it on. And then if you look at peanut butter and jelly, it's the exact same thing. And so this kind of combination of fat, fruit, and something to spread it on is an archetype. It's a law. And the reason I call it the law of peanut butter and jelly is because peanut butter and jelly is really kind of the first complex dish that we learned to make as children in America.
Yeah.
And the more I thought about the things that I was eating that I loved, the more I realized that they all followed these laws. And then I guess I figured out that the dishes that were kind of head-scratchingly wonderful for me that really pushed me, they followed the law, but then something broke it.
Hmm.
And I'm addicted to that play.
What are some of those things?
Oh, for example, you know, I'll have like a foie gras dish, for example, at a great restaurant, and it'll have cocoa nib with it. And adding a bitter component, when generally a foie gras dish will follow the law of peanut butter and jelly, rich foie, fruity something, something to spread it on. So by adding a weird discordant flavor, it becomes like very addictive.
Huh, cool.
Yeah.
So Justin, just list them off. Tell me a few of these laws.
Sure. So the law of peanut butter and jelly, which is about dealing with fruitiness and fats. Then you have the law of coffee, cream, and sugar, which is about dealing with bitter things and how they relate to sweetness and fats. Then you have the law of bagel and lox, which is basically about our relationship with smoke. Hot dog, which is with salty and cured foods. The law of the wedge salad, which is about dealing with funky things like blue cheese or lamb or squab. The law of guacamole, which is about understanding fresh fats, which is kind of my term, but that's plant-based fats. Mm-hmm. The law of cheese fries, which was really weird, which is about dealing with sharp things, things that kind of hit you in the back of the nose, like a sharp cheese or mustard or wasabi. Then you have the law of lemonade, which is commonly found in fast food, which is our play between sweet and sour. The law of pesto, which deals with herbaceousness. The law of General Tso's chicken, which is about spiciness. And finally, the law of gin and tonic, which is about following your nose.
Hmm. What was the hardest law for you to come up with?
I tell you, that's a great question. I want to say it's the law of gin and tonic, which
it's my favorite.
Thank you. It required a lot of research on the internet because these are all based on things that we don't understand. The law of gin and tonic is based on how compounds that we smell are in foods. For example, pork liver and jasmine are actually, the aroma is made up of the same compounds. Weird. Did I know that? No. I'm not a perfumologist and a scientific cook. It was developed by Heston Blumenthal and actually a perfume guy. And so, for example, the gin and tonic, like our noses knew that quinine, juniper, and lime all had similar aromatic compounds. Our noses knew that, but we didn't scientifically know that. You know, we were drinking this in like, you know, malaria times.
Mm-hmm.
Wild, right?
Yeah.
So that was a tough one to pin down.
So one particular recipe that's in this book that you're really known for is the foie gras donut.
Yeah, everybody.
Do you think that people are really going to make foie gras donuts in their houses?
So check it. I just had someone post, and it's only because I'm a narcissist and I constantly Google myself. The recipe popped up from a Texan who lives in New York who made the donut, but then stuffed it with cranberry jam, which is not my recipe, to use up extra cranberry sauce. From Thanksgiving.
Well, look at that.
Yeah, and I was really excited about it. So yes, people are making this.
And what are some of your favorite things that you actually make at home?
I'm really addicted to the not college ramen broth right now, which is in the law of the hot dog. I mean, if you think about ramen, it's basically a liquefied hot dog.
And can you explain the law of the hot dog?
Sure. The law of the hot dog is really about kind of salty and cured things. And so if you think about the saltiness of the ramen broth, and then you add pork belly and you add all these condiments to it, and then you basically just have noodles swimming around in this. The noodles are just like a hot dog bun. The broth is just like the hot dog. And then anything else you want to put on it, you know, from here to Chicago, that's ramen.
Awesome.
I also love the this really great vegetarian chili recipe that a lot of people are like, I can't believe there's no meat in this. We use pecans and dehydrated mushroom, and you grind up the mushroom powder, and that expands and thickens it and creates like all sorts of deep, dark umami chili flavors.
So what do you think these laws teach you about how to cook?
I think they teach you fundamentals that you'll never learn. And the fundamentals are actually about our tongues and our interactions with food. And when I think that when you learn that a lot of really great dishes are based off of simple formulas, you can kind of look through your pantry and say, oh, I have a sweet thing. It's not what the recipe called for, but I have a sweet thing. I have a rich thing. And then you learn how to build. It's in the beginning of the book, I talk about how flavors are like Lego. You know, it's like a system.
Yeah.
All Lego fits together always. And I think once you understand how food fits together, which is what this book is about, you're free to jam. You don't need my book anymore.
Awesome. Well, Justin, thanks so much for being here.
A super pleasure. An honor.
Thanks.
Justin Warner is author of The Laws of Cooking. Von Diaz is a writer and food editor of Feet in Two Worlds. Test out some of Justin's laws in your own kitchen. Find his recipes for Better Tomorrow vegan chili and his infamous foie gras donut. That's worth a try. SplendidTable.org. They do it in Spain, they do it in Portugal, they even do it in Italy. But New England? The tradition of finishing pork with acorns is a beloved European practice. And if Jennifer Milikowski, owner of Walden Hill in Massachusetts, has it her way, it's going to become an American tradition too. Correspondent David Leet talked to Jennifer about the benefits of acorn-fed heritage pork in both taste and in environmental impact.
Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So, talking about acorn-fed pork, that's very much a European tradition. I was very drawn to it because they do that in Portugal and Spain, and I think also Italy. Now, what was it that gave you the idea to bring this tradition here to America and especially New England?
Yeah, you're right. It is a European tradition. It actually started by looking at what we had here in New England. Mm-hmm. We have incredible oak hickory forests.
Right.
And so they produce amazing tree nuts. And once I started realizing that we had this incredible abundance of acorns, and once you start looking into acorns and what you can do with them, you very quickly make the connection to this European tradition of feeding them to pigs and producing an incredible product from it.
What is the difference between acorn-fed pork and regular pork?
The quality of the meat and the flavor of the meat has a lot to do with what that animal is eating. Mm-hmm. Because acorns are quite fatty and they have this nutty, rich fat that these pigs are then consuming, that finished product becomes not just flavorful in the meat, but also incredibly flavorful in the fat. And so that fat is slightly sweeter, it's nuttier, earthier, and people actually talk about acorn-fed pork melting in your mouth. And that's because the fat of the acorns is actually lowering that melting point of that fat. So it's not just a statement that people are making. It's actual reality that at room temperature, that fat will be much looser and it will really seep into that flavor of the meat much more while cooking. And so your finished product just has a lot more flavor throughout.
Now, in Europe, at least in Portugal, where I saw it, and also in Spain, the pigs are just allowed to roam free and do whatever they want and eat as many acorns as they want. What are some of the challenges here? You can't have pigs just running through the Connecticut forests, can you?
Yeah, you're right. In Europe, they let them roam around. And that works for that system because these forests and these pigs have sort of co-evolved over centuries. That's not the case for New England. In fact, in many parts of this country, there's incredible damage that comes from invasive wild hogs. So we have to be careful about sensitive ecosystems. And so rather than having our pigs roam New England forests, instead we work with incredible New England small family farms who are doing things really well, but feeding them more traditional pig feed. And so we partner with them and we harvest thousands of pounds of acorns from forests and native oak trees in the area, and we bring them to the pigs so that the pigs can still have a great life and be treated really well, but they're not in the forest causing damage on this large scale.
One of the things you told me that I was utterly fascinated by is this isn't just something you do in the forest or in farms. This is also a suburban and an urban effort on yours, right?
Yes, it is. It's something that actually I didn't even anticipate starting off, but I've really enjoyed as it's evolved to become a rural, suburban, and urban activity. There's an incredible opportunity to better connect people with our native landscapes and our local food system. Mm-hmm. And so not only are we collecting these nuts from sort of large, widespread forests, but we're also collecting nuts from homeowners who live in more suburban or urban environments and encouraging them to keep their native trees intact and preserving and protecting them. And many people actually currently think of acorns as a nuisance. I've spoken to hundreds of landowners across the region already this fall, and I've heard so many stories from people telling me that they were going to cut down their oak trees.
And these are big, old, gorgeous oak trees.
Oh, yes, absolutely. With a lot of great attributes and a lot of importance from, a public health standpoint, from a native wildlife standpoint. And so by collecting and there's no way we could ever collect all of the acorns, but by collecting right. some of them and putting them to good use, mm-hmm. it really changes the mindset of these homeowners. And that's been really exciting to see. They're not just excited that there's monetary value, but they're just excited that there's inherent value to put these to better use.
And you are centered in New England at the moment, but what are your plans for the future?
Yeah, so we really want to apply our model more broadly, both with types of foods that we're producing and in the regions that we're operating in. There is mm-hmm. a lot of untapped potential to create a more sustainable food system, but it's changing a system that's very big and very ingrained in our culture, so it will take time. But we really hope that region by region, we can look at those natural landscapes and figure out what system makes sense there. It's not about necessarily growing the food that we want everywhere. It's about growing the food that makes sense, and we can take the time to produce really incredible products if we do that.
Jennifer, it was so great to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Milikowski is the owner of Walden Hill Farm. David Leet is the publisher of the website LeetsCulinaria, lccooks.com. Now check out our recipe for Yucatan pork in banana leaves. I cannot tell you what perfect party food this is. Coming up, how to evaluate a grocery store when you peer through the door. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Gordon Edgar became a cheese connoisseur by accident. After a short time as a political activist after college, he found a job in the cheese department in San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery Cooperative. He fell in love, and 21 years later, he's written a book, Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Contributor Patty Hinnich talked to Edgar about the politics behind this cheese that we all know.
Hi, Gordon. So nice to talk to you today about cheese.
It's great to be here.
But what I want to know is, why cheddar?
Well, you know, a couple things. One is that, you know, we're in the midst of this amazing cheese renaissance in the United States right now. You know, there's more great cheese being made here than probably any other time, you know, in the history of the United States in terms of different styles, in terms of really quality stuff. And I kind of asked myself at some point, why did we need this cheese renaissance? You know, why 20 years ago when I started, wasn't it like this? And I kind of realized that the answer to that was cheddar. And it seemed to be something worth exploring. I mean, I think also, you know, there's always something to be gained when you spend a little time, you know, examining something that you usually take for granted.
Yeah.
And I think cheddar is one of those things. You know, it's everywhere. We don't really think about it. But, you know, the history of cheddar has really affected American cheese making in general and also just the food system itself in the United States. And it really reflects kind of the way the American food system has developed.
What are the origins of cheddar here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, cheddar is originally an English cheese. You know, it's been made since the 11th century around the village of Cheddar, England. You know, and it was typically a farm-made product. In the United States, you know, when people started coming over to this land that would become the United States, you know, people also brought cheddar with them and cheddar making. And so it was made, you know, here from very early on. I think that when, you know, if we really want to talk about kind of more modern day cheddar, if we look at 1851 is kind of the important date. That's the date that the Williams family in upstate New York developed the first cheddar factory. You know, before that, pretty much all cheese was made on the farm. The farm wife made it. But this was the first time that people were setting up, you know, a building specifically for making cheese and getting the local farmers to bring their milk to one place to make cheese. And that very much caught on. You know, these things don't all happen at once, of course, but pretty much that changed the way that cheddar was made in the United States and then later other countries as well. And it turned cheddar from a farm product into a factory product. Mm-hmm. It turned the cheese makers from women to men. And it really it began kind of this road for cheddar being made in more and more efficient ways. Mm-hmm. And with, I think a lot of people would say, a lot less, you know, further down the line, a lot less flavor. Because pretty much every development was made to make a cheese as efficiently as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that made a lot of sense, you know, when you're talking about a farm, you know, back in the 1850s and trying to make cheese that didn't rot, that didn't blow up, that didn't get maggots in it, you know.
Yeah.
But then you take it from there, kind of the logical extension of that, if that's your goal, is maximum efficiency, maximum yield, you know, processed cheese like Velveeta is kind of the logical outcome of that. And that's because, you know, there's no loss with Velveeta. I mean, you make it, it lasts forever. You know, it's not going to go bad. There's kind of this perverse logic to it, which I think is also in many ways the logic of the way that a lot of food is produced in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the Industrial Revolution went wild inside of the cheese making, right? Now, tell me a little bit about the color. When did it turn that bright orange?
Well, you know, the coloring is usually annatto. Which is a type of bean. It's a natural coloring.
Annatto seeds. Oh, we have tons of those in Mexico.
Yeah. And it's and you know, honestly, there's some debate about when or, you know, why it started or exactly, you know, whether it was meant to be a fraud or just happened to be. But it basically was meant to disguise the color of the cheese. I mean, the color of the cheese would always be the same if you're using the annatto. Whereas before, you'd have these seasonal differences. You know, if the cows are out there on pasture, the milk is going to be much more yellowy than it is if the cows are eating grain and that kind of thing. And so you used to be able to just tell. You could look at cheese and say, oh, this is from an animal that's grass-fed or has been on pasture, and this one hasn't, you know, I mean, to some extent. But with the addition of annatto, it was an easy way to make cheese look the same all the time.
So, Gordon, where does the best cheddar come from these days?
Well, you know, usually when somebody asks me that question, it's on a regional radio show. If somebody asks me that and they're from Wisconsin, I'll say Wisconsin. Or if they're from Vermont, I'll say Vermont. But, you know, you're national, so I can't really say that. I would say that the best cheddar, you know, it comes from all over the country. People are making good cheddar. It just has certain regional differences. I think that in Vermont, you know, people who grew up in the Northeast really expect this really bitey, bitter, sharp cheddar. And to them, that's just normal. That's what cheddar should be. But if you're from Wisconsin, you know, you want kind of a sweeter, creamier cheddar. And that's what you think cheddar should be. So a little bit, it's hard to answer because different people are really looking for different things. I think that the cloth-bound cheddar, which is kind of the more traditional style of cheddar, it basically went extinct in the United States for, you know, a couple decades until it got brought back. And the people who are making those cheeses, those traditional style cloth-bound cheddars, Grafton makes one, Cabot cloth-bound aged at Jasper Hill, the Flory's Truckle from Missouri, the Fiscalini from California. You know, to me, those are the most amazing cheddars made in the country. And it's because of their style. You know,
right.
You get a more complex flavor, a little less sharp flavor generally, but a little more complex flavor. And it's really, really interesting cheese.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much for talking to us today. This was fascinating.
Well, thanks for having me. It was great.
Gordon Edgar is author of Cheddar, A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. Patty Hinnage is author of Patty's Mexican Table. Gordon left us with a list of his favorite cheddars. Now you can find it at splendidtable.org. From insanely simple how-to videos to creative food hacks and addictive lists, BuzzFeed has changed the game when it comes to food coverage. Emily Fleischaker is the creative director and former food editor for BuzzFeed Life. Classically trained at the French Culinary Institute, she helped launch BonAppetit.com before joining BuzzFeed, where she's been busily redefining ways to cover the food scene. Our contributor, Noelle Carter, got a chance to talk with her.
Emily, it's so great to chat with you. This may be a jam-packed question, but I'm curious, how has our consumption of food content changed over the years?
So much. One of the things that I think has changed at the most recently is Pinterest, the social media bookmarking site. Before, the biggest sources of food media were like magazines and television. Now, people at home can make a recipe, photograph it, put it on their blog, and that's just as accessible and just as compelling to your average home cook as a lot of the content that's being made by magazines and being made on television. And that's really cool because it adds to this much more kind of communal feeling and kind of a greater, more inclusive feeling about food media. And I think that a huge part of this has been Pinterest, because it's like the digital newsstand for food blogs and for the web at large. Pinterest is really where I go to find a new recipe and to then keep track of it for the future. So I don't have like a recipe box in my kitchen anymore. I have Pinterest folders that I keep recipes in.
And you can access them from anywhere.
And I can access them from anywhere. Like, I'm at the supermarket and I want to pull up a recipe to make for dinner that night, which, of course, you know, makes me stand in the supermarket staring at my phone like an idiot. So one could argue that that's not ideal. but it is. It's convenient and it's a nice thing to have.
Definitely. Definitely. One thing I loved that you mentioned was you've called photographs the face of a recipe. Why are visuals so important when it comes to food and social media especially?
I think because there's so much media that we're constantly inundated with all day, every day. And visuals tend to catch your eye, so that if you have a beautiful photo of the recipe, that's going to be able to catch people's attention and also jump from social platform to social platform more easily than just a recipe title. It becomes the face of the recipe, and it sort of becomes like the promotional little content package for the recipe. If you have a great, great photograph of a recipe, it'll show up all over the place. It'll show up on Imgur. It'll show up on Pinterest. It'll show up on people's Instagrams. And that is going to just distribute itself everywhere in a way that is really powerful.
Right, right. One thing I love about BuzzFeed Food is that you guys have cornered the market on how-to cooking videos and food hack videos, not to mention all those addictive lists. Everything is short, sweet, and simple. Can you talk a little bit about how you developed this approach and why you think it works so well?
Yeah. So when I was at Bon Appetit in 2011, 2012, I started reading BuzzFeed, and it was just addictive. And I felt myself starting to write that way. I would do these lists of like 23 sexy corn recipes that you won't get enough of or something. And mm-hmm. it wasn't really in the right voice there, but it felt like the voice of the web. So people were responding to it online. And I think the lists work really well online because people, they want to kind of know what they're getting, because browsing online is often a thing where you feel like there's somewhere else you could be at any moment. And so you kind of need to know, what am I getting out of this before I click on it?
Right.
And I think, you know, another thing that's kind of interesting that we've discovered is that clickbait doesn't actually work, because if you promise someone something in a headline and then you don't deliver, they're not going to share that story. The sharing is actually more important than the click, because the sharing grows your audience. The video thing was an incredible discovery that came out of a context where we were making food every day at the test kitchen and shooting step-by-step photographs. And then one day I just put my phone in front of one of the photo shoots with the Instagram video app setting on and took a video of the recipe coming together. And Instagram at the time, and I think still, only allows you to shoot 15 seconds of video. So it was by nature short. And Instagram also allows you to start and stop shooting. So it's sort of choosing these moments. We're making these Nutella cinnamon rolls, and there's moments of this recipe that are crucial to see, so that if you watched it later, you would know what was going on. So you would spread the cinnamon and the filling out, and I'd make sure that that was showing. And then I'd stop recording, and then I'd show a little bit of the rolling up. And then we used a string to cut the cinnamon roll rather than a knife. And I'd make sure that that was in there. And then finally, I ran out of time on my Instagram video. It was 15 seconds long, and I had to just post the thing. And someone back who runs our social media saw the video on my Instagram and said, hey, can we put this on BuzzFeed Food's Facebook page? And we did, and it got millions and millions of views. And we were kind of blown away. And I think, frankly, that Facebook's algorithm is really heavily favoring video right now. Everyone kind of knows that. But after that happened, we just started making little videos of all the things we were cooking. I mean, it was really just sticking a video camera in front of stuff that we were doing anyways. And I think there's something inherently entertaining about watching food being made in the simplest, quickest way possible. Because the thing that's amazing about cooking is that it is a transformation. You take these ingredients, you put them together, you get something else out of it that's completely different than what you started with. And that concept of transformation is really compelling on video. And that's what cooking is all about.
Emily, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Emily Fleischaker is the creative director of BuzzFeed Life. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, if you want more from your swings through the supermarket, you should meet Steve Jenkins. You could call Steve a master grocer. He's lived the business from the inside out at New York's Fairway Markets. Steve, it's so good to have you back.
I feel the same way, Lynn.
Well, how do you check out a supermarket?
Well, first, I can immediately tell in any food store, whether it's a food shop, a specialty shop, a supermarket, a closeout shop, whatever, mm-hmm. if it's being driven by somebody who's got some taste, who has a sensibility that appeals to me. It's very stark. It's very obvious in a food store whether it's worthy of you, just like cheese. You know, a cheese has to be worthy of you. Most of them are boring as heck.
So if I'm walking into a supermarket, you know, which are pretty much to me cookie cutter,
yeah.
what is it that would set it apart in the way you're talking about it?
Well, immediately you're going to walk into the produce department of a supermarket. They're always going to put the produce up front because that's their rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And if in that department the fruits and the vegetables are abundant and colorful and well-presented and not lying all over the floor, and indeed, more importantly, there's some human being or a number of human beings on the floor who are there ready to talk to you and ready to tell you where something is or ready to offer some opinion about something, that's when I know I'm in a supermarket that has some moxie, some wherewithal,
mm-hmm.
some reason for me to repatronize and spend my money there immediately. Secondarily, it'd be the deli, Lynn. I want to see what they're showing behind that glass, whether or not it looks appealing and abundant and it's signed well, and equally, whether there are people behind the counter who are not so bored that I might as well be talking to a robot. That's as important as how the deli offerings look. And unless I have that bond, I'm not going to rave about this store. I may do business there, but I'm never going to feel like, oh boy, these guys really got it together. I can't wait to get another half a pound of prosciutto because they lay it out so beautifully and they've sliced it so perfectly. You got to hope that that's going to happen. But the best way to make that happen is to try and ferret out somebody behind that counter that's got a light on behind his or her eyeballs that cares about what you're going to serve tonight.
So how can stores foster that with their people? How can they?
By being leaders, by taking their own job seriously, by having passion for the food that they're purveying. It's so rare anymore to go in a supermarket where anybody shows any passion about the food that's there. I see so little evidence of people that take it seriously. You want to get happy? Get passionate. You're going to get paid more. You're going to get more responsibility. You're going to be challenged. Your life's going to be worthwhile, but it all goes back to the food. Show some respect for the food. Show some desire to know everything there is to know about that particular food stuff, like I did. And I did it because I was, frankly, bored out of my mind and I needed to engage myself. So I said, I'm going to learn everything there is to know about every gosh darn thing in here. And you do it on your own time. And guess what? You get rewarded for it.
And there's a world you discover that will entertain you for a very, very long time in your life.
And the day goes faster and you feel better about yourself when you're going home from work to the degree that you get rushes up the back of your neck because you're feeling so good about what you're doing. You're taking something seriously that heretofore you were passing off as just taking up your time. Not so.
Steve, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my. Me too, Lynn. Thanks.
It occurs to me we might want to take a page from the Europeans. In Europe, counter women and counter men are viewed as professionals, and I gather they're paid accordingly. Wouldn't be a bad idea to start thinking that way here. Well, Steve Jenkins is author of the classic Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer, and you can find his list of best picks from the supermarket at splendidtable.org. Coming up, it's time for your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Yeah.
Well, it's time for your calls. Now, you know how to get a hold of us. Call us, 800-537-5252. Nick has called us from Alexandria, Virginia. Nick, welcome. What would you like to talk about?
So I recently moved in with my fiance, and we live like less than a five-minute walk from an international grocery store. All kinds of South American and Asian and Middle Eastern and all kinds of food I have no idea what to do with. And I figure since it's so convenient, I should know what I'm doing. Any tips on how I can get started using the new flavors available to me?
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. What do you like to eat? Is there a particular culture or particular country that you really find yourself drawn to in terms of the food?
I'm up for pretty much anything. I do really like South American food, but I'm kind of up for whatever. I'm looking for something fairly simple to start off.
Well, yeah. And that makes sense. I think what would be a great idea, I'm just thinking now, wait a minute, let me give this a little bit of thought. I'll bet you they have plantains.
They do.
Okay. Now, you know, a plantain looks like a banana, but
right.
Yeah, but you really have to cook it. Otherwise, it's pretty awful. And you could make mashed plantain where you peel away the skin, any kind of strings that are involved, cut it up. You can simmer it in water or steam it. I like to do it with thin sliced garlic and chopped onion, which all gets very soft. And then you mash that all together. Now, the other thing you're going to find in the store, it coming in little boxes, is achiote, A-C-H-I-O-T-E.
Okay.
And these are little hard, kind of nubby looking things. And when it makes everything a beautiful yellow color, like saffron, you know, the color of saffron, that yellow, red, golden yellow. And it has a slight peppery quality. So what you do is very hard to grind up. I sometimes take it, I put it on a piece of paper towel, and I just take one of my skillets and slam it just to break it up a little bit. But saute that with sweet peppers, red and yellow peppers, and some onion, okay, and a bit of tomato. But first of all, saute that with the garlic. Slowly, low heat. You don't want to burn the garlic. And everything will turn this gorgeous color. And then you add, saute in the onion and the peppers, and then finally the tomato, and cook that all down. All right?
Okay.
Take your mashed plantain, pile that on the plate, and blend in that whole mixture.
That sounds fantastic.
And then what you do is you put a wedge of lime on everybody's plate, because when they take a spoonful of it, it's a meal unto itself. You can just squeeze lime over it, and it's really good.
All right, awesome. Thank you.
You are welcome. Call again when you want to try another culture. We'll give it a shot.
Will do. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Take care, Nick. Bye.
Absolutely.
I have a discovery I've got to share with you. I am not crazy about every honey that every bee in the world has made. But I came across a honey recently that's really haunting. And it haunted me so much that it was given to me as a gift. It's a barrel-aged honey. And it's from a small apiary. It's called Turkey Hill. And they will mail order. You can find them online. And they have bourbon and I think rum. And what they do is they take the honey and they age it in barrels that have been used to age those whiskeys. And the thing about this honey that I love, first of all, it's not super sweet. And it's not that – and it's a wildflower honey. These bees are, as they would say, free range. And there's all kinds of things, you know, growing around. So it's not that it's a single flower or a single plant honey. But it has this lovely depth to it. It's rich. And it has kind of a dry finish, the way you would say a wine has a, you know, the last thing taste in your mouth is not sweetness, but a dryness that's very pleasant. And that's this honey. It is so good in a cup of good coffee, I can't tell you. Never mind tea and on toast and all of those other things. It's a honey, it's quite expensive. So it's a honey I'd rather use as a topping or whatever rather than throw it in a recipe, because I really want to taste the honey and I want to celebrate it. It would be a fabulous gift for yourself or for anyone else. Turkey Hill barrel-aged honey. Just check it out. It's really interesting. 800-537-5252. We have Alicia on the line calling from Santiago, Chile. Alicia, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. I have to tell you, I am totally geeking out right now talking to you.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm kind of geeking out. I don't get many calls from Santiago, Chile. No, Lisa, are you living there?
I am. I've been here for about 7 years now.
And what do you do?
I teach English and I translate.
What made you decide on Chile?
Well, I came to learn Spanish, and I just thought this was kind of a fun country, and then I stayed for the wine.
I can understand that. I can understand that totally. I understand it's also quite lovely there. But
it's
but
beautiful.
I gather you have a question.
I do. Well, as you know, living in another country, sometimes it's hard to find ingredients that you need. And my friend is having a baby shower soon, and I wanted to make her something similar to like a York peppermint patty kind of a cake. She loves those things, and we can't get them here. And I also am having a hard time finding mint extract.
Well, you can mail. Now, you can mail order mint extract. Frontier Spices has really classy extracts. It's going to probably cost you a fortune. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Have you got fresh mint available there?
Yes, I can. I could do something with some fresh mint, yeah.
You could infuse it. You know, what you could do is, I mean, take a big handful of the leaves, okay, and pour some hot water over. Well, no, wait a minute. Let's go backwards for a minute. First of all, you're going to make a sugar syrup.
Okay.
Which is really, this is really easy. 1.5 parts sugar. So let's say 1.5 cups of sugar to 1 cup of water. And you're going to put that in a saucepan and simmer it until it's clear. And you can cover it if you want to, because the idea is you just want to get a really nice and dense sugar syrup. And then what you're going to do is, while it's still warm, you're going to stir into it the biggest tight handful of mint, spearmint specifically, not peppermint, spearmint you have ever seen. And you're going to cover the pot, and you're going to let it sit for maybe 10 minutes, and then you're going to take a teaspoon, take a little taste, blow on it first because it's really hot. And I mean really cool it down and taste. Is it intense enough? Maybe not. You're going to test it every 10 minutes until you've really infused the mint, and then you can strain it and you can put it in a jar. Now, it's not going to have the alcohol that a mint extract would have, but you're going to have the mint flavor. It may not be quite as intense as you'd like it to be, but you can make it more intense by pureeing, taking a little bit of it and pureeing more fresh mint into it until you get it where you want it. Now, you could take a standard cake recipe, okay, anything you would like that's very simple. And what what you do is you're going to take fresh coconut. You must be able to get fresh coconut, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to take fresh coconut. And again, you're going to cook that coconut for a bit with sugar in a big skillet. And you're going to have, I'm going to just thinking this out for a minute. You're going to do the coconut with a bit of vanilla and sugar to taste. Get it to the point where it's kind of sticky, okay, in a sauté pan. You've baked the cake. You want to cut it into two layers, all right? And you're going to spread. You're going to cool down that mixture, and you're going to spread it in there. And if you want to, you could cool it down, get it cold, fold in a little bit of whipped cream.
Ooh.
Yeah, so you make it like a creamy filling. And then I would do the mint extract sprinkled over that. And then the final thing you're going to do is melt chocolate, okay, and you're going to drizzle it all over the cake so that it comes streaking down the sides or even covers the sides. And you're going to just let that set, and you're home free.
Excellent. That sounds delicious.
That will be sort of a takeoff of one huge peppermint patty.
Yes. I think I can do that.
I think you're going to really – I think it'll work. And tell her happy birthday from me.
Okay, I will.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Yep, bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Tricia is calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
Tricia, what is on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
So every winter, my kids and I, for the past few winters, cook our way through different regions of the world and use that as a way to explore the culture and history of the country as well.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And my kids this year picked Italy, so I thought, who better to call than you to get some advice on different regional dishes, as well as ideas of how to explore the different cultural nuances throughout Italy. So I was hoping you could give some examples or some ideas for us to cook this winter, beyond the traditional, you know, ragouts and
bechamel. Yeah, no, I understand. Sort of I understand. You know, there's a dish, this might get too involved, though, because there is a wonderful dish that is done in Sicily where you butterfly a chicken. And it could be a Cornish hen if you want to, you know, something small, something bigger. And then you pack around it fresh bay leaves. And you rub it with olive oil and garlic, and you usually use orange zest and clove, because bay leaves, fresh or dried, tend to have an overtone of those flavors. And okay. You can do it with dried bay leaves too. And the idea is you literally pack this flattened butterflied bird in those bay leaves, and you let it sit basically on lightly covered, you don't want to seal it, in the refrigerator for 2 days.
Okay.
And then you get rid of the bay leaves and you slowly, you know, cook it under the broiler, but don't cook it too fast. And you baste it with a combination of white wine and a bit of orange. And it is just wonderful.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Or you could do, you know, if you have lemon zest, you would do squeeze with lemon and finish it with a bit of lemon. And it's very, very simple. Obviously, you want salt. And if it's possible, coarse salt. You'll use less of it and you'll get this nice crunch. That's how I've had that dish.
Sure. Okay.
So that could be, again, not a very famous dish from Sicily.
No, but that sounds wonderful. That's
exactly
what we're
looking
for.
This is an area that grows citrus fruit and is famous for it. There is a dish from Puglia, the heel of the boot. Mm-hmm. And now this is a dish that has an interesting history. It's called stampu in local dialect. And what it is wheat berries, you know, that you can buy. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, they are put in a deep wooden mortar, you know, something that's about 2 feet deep with a big pestle, you know, out of wood. And mm-hmm. what the women would do is they would pound it to release the skin. It's called the pellicule.
Oh, wow.
On the wheat. That's why it's called stampu. They're stomping it and with
sure.
this pestle. And then they boil it, and however you would serve pasta, you serve this.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
And this, again, great wheat-growing area, a lot of olive trees, so you'd always have olive oil. And one of the ways I had it that was just fabulous was chopped, you know those wrinkled black olives?
Yes.
Yeah, you pit them. I mean, you could use any pitted imported olive, you know, a Greek one or whatever, but this was out of this world. You pit them, you have olive oil, you toss olive oil in a pan with a bit of slivered garlic mm-hmm. and some basil leaves, and then you toss in a handful of these pitted olives, and that gets tossed into the, you know, the wheat that you've boiled. You just boil it with a little salt.
Sure.
And it's just delicious. And you can put some fresh tomatoes in there if you want to, like grape tomatoes. And it's wonderful. Also, it's served a lot of times with ricotta and cinnamon. And it's served warm as a dessert.
That sounds lovely.
It would be a wonderful breakfast for the kids.
Oh, yeah, they'd love that.
And that's a tradition of the planting of the wheat, which is done in the winter.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for those recommendations.
You are more than welcome. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week. Let me leave you with this thought from Dennis Miller, who said, Washington, D.C. is to lying what Wisconsin is to cheese.
Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. If you want to track down more information on anything you heard here today, head to splendidtable.org. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It comes out weekly, and it's filled with ideas to help you feed yourself and your friends and family midweek. You can register for our monthly giveaways and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there in one place, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Alexandra Baumhardt. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM.